Welcome back to Editing Aloud, and all the best for a new year, but some old problems. A December in which Eskom really battled to keep the lights on, succeeding over Christmas, but load shedding for at least some of the time. And a year which has opened with the resignation of Eskom acting CEO and chairman Jabu Mabuza, prompting a political storm around Pravin Gordhan, the shareholder minister, and the board. Lukhanyo, what do you make of Jabu Mabuza's resignation from Eskom? Did he jump? Was he pushed?
No, it is, I mean, it's hard to know what was actually said in private meetings, but I think once his namesake, David Mabuza, came out publicly, or the deputy president, and said, you know, like that's the President Ramaphosa had been misled by Eskom and by the minister, I think Jabu's position probably became really difficult to sustain because, I mean, he either had to defend himself or take the route that he took. Obviously, there's a lot of intrigue about what's the politics behind this. I mean, was this a ploy to go after Mabuza, or is that some kind of proxy war to go after, like, you know, his political leaders? Like, in terms of, like, is it the thing to go after Pravin, or are they trying to go after Cyril himself, or is it part of broader ANC factional battles? You know, because the ANC still hasn't recovered from the whole undecisive sort of like Nasrec thing from 2017, so like it's still far from being a united party. So there's a lot of intrigue, a lot of politics, but I think his position really became unsustainable once like he'd come under such heavy public attack from a deputy president.
Warren Thompson, not that any power utility, frankly, anywhere in the world should ever promise not to load shed, and I have to say the president was not wise to repeat that promise. But I mean, did you get the feeling that for Jabu Mabuza this was about falling on his sword because of the promise that had supposedly been broken? Or was he kind of looking for a way to exit long before? What was your feeling about that?
Yeah, I think he was always installed. My sense was that he was always installed as an interim. He started off as the chairman, was parachuted in there, and then obviously he had to step into the CEO role for a while. But we know there's a lot of politics going on. But there's palpable frustration, I think, from all quarters in South African society about what Eskom has promised us in terms of load shedding and what's actually happened. I mean, we remember that it was late November or early December when the president was on his way to Egypt and we got ratcheted up to stage 6 load shedding in a matter of minutes with no idea why or how. And I think certainly from the big energy users, the mines and the smelters, like, you just cannot run, we cannot tolerate this anymore. I mean, I think there's going to be more job losses. So there's certainly frustration, I think, all around. Rather just, as we were speaking off air, Hillary, rather tell us the worst case scenario and then perform better than that, than this chaos, which is almost hourly change in the kind of status of the grid.
Now the new chief executive, André de Ruyter Lukhanyo, has now begun. Are we expecting that somebody might start to get a grip on this thing, even if it's going to clearly take a long time to fix?
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, I just had to warn, I mean, we're talking about the load shedding that was unexpected this December. Because you remember we had a press conference in December 2018 when we all went to Megawatt Park and we were told there isn't going to be any load shedding for a month. At least I think that time there was actually no load shedding for a month. And then, but then January came and then there was havoc. And then I think the economy shrunk by 3.1% or something like quarter, mainly to do to Eskom. So, like, this has been, as you said, this has been a long-running problem. And, I mean, whether one person is going to come in and fix it in a space of a couple of weeks, couple of months, these are bit structural issues, right? These are political issues about... The thing with Eskom, it still feels like, to me, we've always known what needs to be done in a way, because, like, there's, you know, all these proposals... there was that report that the president to the commission in 2018, I think, from the latest...
But I suppose, Genevieve, the politics are such that whatever proposals are put in place to fix it don't necessarily seem to get implemented.
Absolutely.
And talk about the politics, because we've really had a bit of an eruption of what seems to be an internal ANC battle around Pravin Gordhan and the resignation of Jabu Mabuza.
Sipho Padiana yesterday was quite right to say that Eskom is being used as a political football. And actually, Natasha Marion writes in her column this week for Financial Mail, the issue, it comes down in what happened recently and this new backlash against Gordhan, now from the camp that seemed to be the CR camp, is that Didi and PG have had a fallout. So apparently, Didi Mabuza
Pravin Gordhan would have
sidelined by Pravin Gordhan in the Eskom war room.
He was supposed to be the chair of the war room.
Yes.
Didi Mabuza.
And so egos have been hurt. Also, Didi Mabuza in all of this, we know there's been a big issue with Cyril Ramaphosa being a bit fluffy up and down. He doesn't really want to say what's going on, what he believes, is this right, is this wrong. There's always shock, horror, oh no. And then Didi Mabuza steps in and goes, we were misled. That's it, we were misled. He actually shows up Cyril in a way. He's starting to look more like the leader than Cyril Ramaphosa's looking.
So is this, it's a platform or a proxy for finding a battle within the ANC? Yeah. Is this coming out into the open now, Genevieve?
Then we have this new call of let's give Eskom to the energy department.
Which is Gwede Mantashe.
Which is Gwede Mantashe, who, let's be quite honest, hasn't done really well in terms of implementation. And here's this has been the issue. There are all these plans, there's no implementation. And how many times do we have to say, government, get it together, ANC, get it together, can we implement, the policies are there. Sipho Padiana again said that yesterday. But now you've got Gwede Mantashe and Pravin Gordhan, two key allies of President Ramaphosa, who are being pitted against each other. And now, and then if we go back to the moving the Eskom to the energy department, so obviously say that there's a fallout between Didi Mabuza and PG, and he's still on good terms with Gwede. But Gwede's track record, we saw this morning, that the entire Nexa board, which falls under the energy department, resigns. What's their reason?
Which is the Atomic Energy Agency. Yes.
What's their reason?
Political interference.
They are frustrated by the minister who hasn't signed off on anything, so it hampers them from doing their work.
So if you thought Pravin Gordhan was interfering in the boards of the enterprises that he controls, so is Gwede Mantashe.
But now this is the other touch. Gwede's not doing anything. That's what they're complaining about. Nexa says, we have sent you a detailed report of what we need to do to turn this around. They had liquidation problems. And Gwede hasn't signed it. And
but the same goes, Warren Thompson, for all the renewable energy exemptions and contracts that Gwede hasn't signed either. I mean, so in a sense, Pravin Gordhan and Gwede Mantashe were perhaps, we don't really know, at odds before over electricity. But either way, what does it do to sort of investment and the private sector if this renewable energy thing continues to be held up apparently by a lack of a signature?
Yeah, I think it's. I think that's really what's so depressing about this is why these little palace intrigue and games are being played. The economy is bleeding jobs. Investor confidence, as you know, is at rock bottom. And it looks like once again that the intrigue and the horse trading inside the ANC is taking precedence over the welfare of the nation.
Yeah.
And that's simply how it's coming across. If you expect investors to look at that and say, well, this is a time. Neil Froneman was borderline saying that...
It's Sibanye Stillwater.
Yeah, this mining industry of ours is effectively dead and buried until someone starts making decisions. And we can get this Eskom fixed and new sources of supply onto the grid, which they have literally queued up. It just requires a signature and I think a connection from Eskom, and that would be one source. But again, it's all sitting below what's taking place inside the ruling party.
Look, on your implications for growth, we're looking at a pretty bleak sort of outlook, aren't we? With the Monetary Policy Committee meeting tomorrow, are they going to revise down the 2020 growth forecast again? What is the economy looking like for this coming year?
I mean, we've had a really bit of a dismal start. And if they say economics is a dismal science, we've had a really dismal start to the year, I must say. I mean, I think the Reserve Bank's forecast in November was for growth of 1.4% this year. And we know we're not going to be anywhere near that already. I mean, for example, we know just from this week that Nedbank had come in with their own forecast, just half of that, 0.7.
For 2020.
For 2020, yeah. So Nedbank has already come at 0.7%. The World Bank has come at under 1%. And I think Standard Bank also had a new forecast. So the it almost goes without saying the Reserve Bank's 1.4 forecast, we might as well forget about that completely. I mean, obviously, they're going to say, I mean, in terms of monetary policy, they don't necessarily target growth, right? They target, I mean, it's part of the mandate, broader mandate, but they issue inflation. But even I think even the inflation target, or they so the inflation forecasts are going to be way out of the window already. I think they're looking for an average of 5.1% for the whole of 2020. I mean, last year, I think they were looking for
so inflation forecasts are lower than expected. Mm. Growth forecasts, likewise, are lower than expected.
Exactly.
Are we even going to get a positive number for last year, 2019?
It's going to be touch and go, isn't it? Because we were looking, obviously, we'd like, you know, that to be quite bad headlines for Cyril Ramaphosa, because that would mean that we've had two recessions. if there is a negative, because the third quarter came out as a shocker, -0.6. Mm. So if the fourth quarter does also come negative, and then obviously a technical recession that we have on hand. Now that means, like, since Ramaphosa came into office in February 2018, we would have had two recessions. I mean, that's not like what the
Ramaphosa. So the optics are not good.
No,
as they say.
It's not what the Ramaphosa was about, and the new dawn was about.
It's really got a legacy which is proving really impossible to address. Though, even given that business is saying it's not impossible, just do something. I mean, do you feel, Genevieve, that the dynamics between business and government are almost changing? I mean, government, Cyril Ramaphosa keeps saying our door is open.
Yes, and it keeps
and they clearly do talk to each other, but
the private
happens.
Sector must do more and come on board. Mm.
And the private sector keeps saying, could you do more, perhaps?
And correct me if I'm wrong. The private sector, so all these business organizations, BUSIC, it can go sit with the president every week, every month, whatever, and have a chat about what's happening. But they can't, you as a CEO of a company or the, cannot go and say, dictate or make policy decision. That still lies with the president and with government. So you can talk to each other. But if the implementation's not happening from government side, what else can private sector do? I understand they can maybe invest more, but
they need a signature.
They need a signature, yeah.
More often than not.
Yes.
Lots of news in retail. This week, Massmart stepping up to close stores, DIY stores, and potentially retrench up to 1,500 workers. Edcon closing more stores, which is already in voluntary business rescue. And at Woolworths, a new chief executive stepping in to replace the old chief executive, Ian Moyer, who presided over quite a difficult time at the retailer. Look, Kanyo, what does certainly the store closing, what does all this shifting in retail actually tell us about the sector and about the economy?
I suppose if you can look at this sector as some kind of bellwether for how the person at home is feeling about the economy, and it's not a good sign, right? I mean, unemployment at record levels. I mean, obviously, in the last couple of years, we've had we had tax increases, no jobs, and I don't think hardly anybody's getting any pay increases. So obviously, that's filtering through into the retail stores. And what's scary about it? It feels as a cross. It doesn't really go. It doesn't matter whether you're Woolworths at the high end or ShopRite at the bottom end. Everybody seems to be feeling the same kind of pain. It's not even a case of saying, you know, at least if you're like this part of this of the market, you should be okay. Like, there isn't that kind of sense. So it's quite gloom all around. But I think, I mean, we just need to get this economy going, right? Because I mean, this people need to spend and people need to have confidence. And I mean, I think we had our last numbers, consumer confidence. The last number was quite flat, but still near 2-year lows. And I know business confidence is running at lows since like the days of PW bought it. So it's not really a kind of environment where you'd expect like retail sales companies to be booming. You know?
Warren, if you were Massmart, if you were Walmart, which bought into Massmart several years ago, what would you be saying to your shareholders?
Well, fortunately, it's a fairly inconsequential slice of the Walmart pie. I mean, that is an enormous beast. And even as big as Massmart is in South Africa, it's tiny in the scope of just the profits it generates in the United States. So it makes it a little bit uncomfortable, and you wonder when they're going to revisit the thesis. I mean, the idea when they bought Massmart was that they were going to use it to understand the market and then use it as a platform to expand into Africa. That clearly hasn't happened. The investment has performed very poorly. So it's almost getting to the brink where if you're sitting in a boardroom I think they're based in Nebraska or somewhere in the Midwest, and you look at this tiny little business that you've got at the southern tip of Africa, it almost looks like it's inconsequential. You've taken the hit on your investment already because it's a listed price that feeds into your value of the business. You might say, well, let's just sell it.
But more broadly, I mean, what do you see? Because in fact, Massmart is looking at closing that sort of upper end of its upper end stores, which you would have thought Dion White, one would have thought might have survived a little bit better.
Well, yes, but as Lucania pointed out, we're seeing the pain across the board. At the same time as you've seen this slowdown in real salary increases, including now that's starting to feed into the government as it tries to curtail its public sector wage bill. You've also seen the increase in administered prices, but also the banks have been extremely prudent in lending. And that's often been a source of money that finds its way into the retail sector, is credit card lending, personal loan lending, and they've been exceptionally conservative over the last few years, which has seen these credit loss ratios reaching like almost decade lows. So that's another factor, and that's unlikely to change. Some of them are turning on the taps, but that's unlikely to change in this economy. So all around, we had a great run, I think, from about 2004 until 2016. The consumer, you saw disposable incomes rising, generally more people being employed every year, but that's all reversed now. And effectively, you've got a bit of a legacy effect. You've got too much retail competition and footprint. And that has to
and too little disposable income. While we're on the subject of banking, Lucanio, a person who you and I know well from the Reserve Bank, Daniel Manelli, is Absa's new chief executive, started today. I think.
Yes.
Mm. How do you think he'll do as a commercial banker? And what is his challenge at Absa?
It's an interesting one. I mean, I think Warren has written quite a bit about this as well. As you said, even though his initial background wasn't commercial banking, like in Germany and the UK and here, but then he had 20 years in the Reserve Bank, and 20 years in which the sector has transformed massively. You know, all these new entrants, some of these new digital banks, and Absa still very much an old legacy sort of business. And I mean, there are some people who say, who argue that these legacy big banks won't exist in 10, 20 years' time.
Warren, is that the case? Are we not going to have Absa or Standard or not in their present form in 20 years' time?
20 years' time, I might have been a bit too drastic in my...
It wouldn't be the first time the end of certainly branch banking had been predicted. But Warren, I mean, what are his challenges at Absa?
He's got quite a few. I think it's in a better position having come out of Barclays now. It's kind of settled down. They've set a strategy. He's going to come in and appraise that strategy. Lucania and I also noted that six-month cooling off period, Daniel would have spent studying Absa and studying his market. So while he is coming from the central bank into one of the commercial operators, I think he will be very well read and very well informed with the publicly available information around the market, et cetera, et cetera. But he's essentially coming into a retail bank that's on the back foot. It's behind the curve technology-wise, and it's begun to reassert itself, but it's still very much kind of the competitor that's been losing market share as opposed to gaining market share over the last few years. So we suspect that his time is really going to be spent making sure that retail, that big retail business banking unit, which generates about 50 to 60% of the profits, starts winning back its market share in some of the key markets where it was a leader, like in home loans.
Genevieve, I'm going to ask you a question, sort of about the politics of banking, because thinking about it, Daniel Manelli has gone from the Reserve Bank to Absa. Well, went from commercial to central, back to commercial banking. But we've also had quite a lot of a revolving door, in fact, lately. We've had Lungisa Fuzile go from the Treasury to Standard Bank. We've had Francois Groepe also go from the Reserve Bank to Discovery Bank. There may be, and we sadly don't have people going in the other direction from private to public. Well, we wish there were more of them. But, but is it a good thing that there is this kind of crossover from public sector to private sector?
Yes, and I do think it is, because it gives more of an understanding. Maybe that's where partnership between government and the private sector maybe become a bit better or easier, because someone now who say has gone from the public sector into the private sector can say, well, I know how it works on the other side.
If we want to, how government works,
if we want to engage with someone with this is our idea, this is the way we should actually go about getting our submission to the president, the minister, or whoever. It would be nice if it happened more the other way around as well, because I think, and the president has spoken about it.
Well, I suppose we've got Andre de Ruyter having gone at least from the private sector to Eskom, but not enough in that direction.
No, because that lack of skill that we have in government, because so many people got so disenchanted with what was happening within the state, the corruption that have now, or they were persecuted because they weren't part of the group who were willing to loot, have all moved out now and taken all that skill with them. So who wants to come back in when, with maybe 2 years ago, everyone was like, oh, maybe we want to go to Mamina and work with President Cyril Ramaphosa. But if someone had to ask now, and didn't we see it with the Eskom CEO issue? Yeah. How difficult was it to find?
We'll know President Ramaphosa in succeeding in building a capable state when people start lining up to take those jobs, because at the moment you have to kind of drag them into the public sector jobs.
Now that you mentioned it, Hillary, I was actually reading in the Bloomberg today, they were speculating about, is it Gary Kennedy, the Nedbank CIB, who's actually upon retiring, they were alluding to him possibly going into the public sector.
So maybe
you might see a bit of
as
that.
As long as the door revolves both ways. In the meantime, we have had the long-awaited Peter Moyo Old Mutual judgment, or at least one of them. Old Mutual winning in court, getting the appeal against, enabling it to go ahead and appoint a new CEO. Look, Kanye, were you surprised that Old Mutual actually won this time around?
I mean, a little bit. I must say, when the headlines came, I mean, you can see the reaction from the markets. I mean, obviously, it was not something that, I suppose maybe if they were expecting it, they might have traded it on it before. So maybe the markets were not expecting it either. I mean, having lost the previous case. I mean, it hasn't really been a good 6-7 months for Old Mutual.
So the previous case, the High Court judge said he could be reinstated.
Could be reinstated.
And the appeal court has now said, no, he can't be reinstated.
They seem to argue also it's impractical. Once you've lost each other's faith in each other and trust in each other, how can you then go and work together? That seems to be the crust of the argument. And I suppose it's disappointing for Moyo, obviously, and I'm sure Trevor Manuel will see this as a big vindication because he's somebody who came under quite a lot of attack towards late of last year, with his unguarded statements about the judge and all those things.
Warren, is this good? I mean, will this be good for?
So this
Old Mutual taken a lot of strain, and does this help?
Absolutely, I think it's given clarity now. They can now appoint a permanent successor to Peter. But I think the issue around the reinstatement was like a technical issue. That the real meat is still to come around the substance of what actually happened with this. This private investment vehicle that Peter Moyo was a shareholder of, and its relationship with Old Mutual. So I think the feeling was that a very decisive win for Old Mutual here, but I think the news could get worse for Mr. Moyo as it goes along.
This is not going to end.
Is he going to leave it here?
But lastly, I have to get to the news that's been on absolutely everybody's lips and thoughts. Not a South African story, though a story which does touch on South Africa, which is Mexit, Genevieve. Harry and Meghan retiring from full-time working life. You've just been in the UK on holiday. What do you make of this?
People are so upset in the UK. I mean, just heard everyone talking about it.
Upset because they're leaving, or upset because?
Upset. And all the blame is going to Meghan Markle. It's her fault. There seems to be quite a bit of hate for her in the UK. And I say hate, it's a strong word, but wow. Even the analysis on the situation.
And how much of it is racial? Mm. I mean, coming with a South African lens, it's hard not to see that there's a strong racial.
I think even with the UK lens, it depends who you read. If you read The Guardian, obviously that's what I was reading. Even I'm reading about it. That's how exciting it is. I was reading Susan Moore's column yesterday in The Guardian about it, where she alluded to these issues of bigotry and how it's a blow for the UK in a sense, if you go back to the US when Barack Obama, first black president, sort of post-racial society. And I think this marriage with Meghan's mixed background was this idea that there's a modernization of the royal family and a new type of
religion.
That's more in tune with how it's changed and how it's much more multicultural. So that if like then this person who's quite privileged in a position feels like no, this country is too unaccepting of her because of her background, that she has to run away. It sort of does put a bit of a dampener on that thought, on that idea.
Leaving only one question, Warren, very quickly, what chance that they can be so financially self-sufficient as they
I'm amazed they actually plan. Aren't already, Hillary. I mean, Meghan has had a very accomplished career in acting. I can only imagine that her ticket, her salary per movie, per series is going up in multiples now that she is still, or now that she's a princess. So I think there will be no shortage of work for her. And I understand that parts of the royal family already are ambassadors for Land Rover, etc., etc. So if Harry wants to attach his name to that, that type of thing, become an ambassador for various brands, including his own foundation, which he really wants to spend most of his time at, there will literally be no shortage of opportunities.
It all feels a little uncomfortable and awkward, but it has been suggested, for example, that Meghan could play Meghan in the next series of The Crown. So yeah. We're going to leave it there. That's all we have time for now, but please do join us again next week for another edition of Editing Aloud.